morning and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, how can Democrats talk about race in this year's election and win? We'll hear from UC Berkeley's Ian Haney Lopez about his book, Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. But first, for 10 days, firefighters across the state have been battling hundreds of lightning-induced wildfires that have leveled more than 1 million acres, caused hundreds of thousands of evacuations, and claimed at least 7 lives. In the Bay Area, 3 mostly uncontained fires are still raging, including the SCU complex fire in the South Bay and the LNU fire in the North Bay, both of which are among the largest in state history. We'll get an update on containment efforts and evacuation orders, and we'll also talk about how the pandemic is affecting firefighting capacity and our ability to keep evacuees safe. And we want to hear from you. Tell us how you've been affected by the fires. Have you been forced to evacuate? What questions do you have? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. Joining us first tonight is Scott McLean, Chief of Information for Cal Fire. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I guess I'd like to start out by saying, how are you doing?
Well, today was much better than the previous days here on the LNU Lightning Complex. Weather was conducive to our efforts. By that, I mean last night we had predicted thunderstorms coming, supposed to be coming through, and they did not materialize. So we had no lightning to contend with. We actually had a little precip, but we did have some wind. So a lot of work got done last night around the Hennessy, as well as the Wahlberg fires. We still have a long way to go, but it was very rewarding on the work that was taking place yesterday. The increase in acreage was for the whole complex was just over 1,000 acres, so that kind of tells you how hard everybody's working right now.
And what in the LNU fire, what are you all focused on? Is it trying to keep it from getting down south to Monterio or keeping Healdsburg safe? What's the real focus?
And the predominant activity on the Hennessy fire, the largest one that wraps around Lake Berryess, is the upper northwest corner towards Middletown. It is very active at this time. And that is in the area roughly of the Jerusalem, the Rocky, and the Clayton fires of the last few years. So, again, it's difficult access, and the fuels are extremely dry and very receptive to the fire. Moving over to the Wahlberg fire, the second in size, again, that is on the east and southeastern corners. It is very active as well. That's the fire that would head towards Healdsburg and Windsor and that fire.
And what will you be working on tonight and tomorrow regards to that fire?
Continuing to strengthen those lines that has the potential of heading into those or towards those communities. Again, there's been a lot of black line. I'm going to take a peek here. The Hennessy fire, I believe, is up to 29% containment, so that's a good increase. The Wahlberg's up to 7%, but again, they've made a lot of progress. So the predominant work on the Wahlberg is on the eastern edge as well as the southeastern edge, and on the Hennessy would be on the northwestern edge towards Middletown.
And tell us a little bit about the SCU fire. How is that? That's the one down in the South Bay. Is that enjoying equal improvement?
I don't have much information on that. It is at 15% contained. It has got the update stats on that. And it's burned 360,055 acres to date. So, again, these two fires are ranked 2 and 3 in the state. Mendocino Complex back in 18 was 451,000 acres. So that is still the first largest fire in California's reported history. So in SCU, we're looking at their second largest now, and we are here at LNU, the third largest currently. And those totals shift back and forth. So that tells you that things are still very, very volatile.
And I noticed that evacuation orders were lifted in parts of the LNU mm-hmm. fire. Can people return to their homes now?
They need to watch their NICSL posts, and they need to watch our updated sheets. As those areas are deemed safe, whether they be making sure that the utilities are applicable and in a safe position, there's no threat of fire, the roadways are passable, then those evacuation orders and or warnings will be lifted. But we are definitely making sure the situations are safe for the public to return in those areas. And we understand. We want to get those folks back as soon as possible.
Well, it's so difficult, obviously, fighting a fire like these. They're huge. They're complicated. They're in rough terrain. Mm-hmm. On top of that, we're hearing a lot of reports nationally that the lack of inmate firefighters might have hampered or is hampering the efforts. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The inmate population, in reference to our inmate firefighting program, has decreased in size. That is correct. But keep in mind that Governor Newsom also allocated funds to bring on over 850 seasonal firefighters for Cal Fire to fill in those voids. And those have all been hired, and they are either in training, and most of them actually are out on the line, to be honest with you, supplementing with several hand crews from the National Guard. So we've got boots on the ground from the Guard to help supplement that, as well as the air. Our 3C, or California Conservation Corps crews, have increased in size as well. So we're doing well on that aspect as far as the supplements. And as far as resources, they continue to come in from out of state. I can give you a little stat here on that. 91 engines, fire engines, have come from out of state to assist us from Arizona, Idaho, New Mexico, Texas, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. And we still have 8 more en route from Montana. Right now, we're looking at 14,000 individuals assigned to all these fires in the state. In 2018, we're looking over 15,000 at the height of the battle. Keep in mind, too, over 1.2 million acres has burned in the last week. Compare that to 1.9 million for the year of 2018.
It's incredible. We have a caller, Kolja from San Francisco. Kolja, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, I just had a brief question. How about San Francisco proper and urban areas, L.A.? I know they had an east of L.A., but how about the city itself? Any chance? I know it's a difficult question.
Any chance that there could be fire in San Francisco? Scott?
Proper, yeah. Okay, I'm not going to, there's chance anywhere in this state of fire, and that's not to make you scared by any means, but we all need to work together. We all need to be prepared. That's the bottom line. There are certain areas of San Francisco with the vegetation and the growth and the density, it's very susceptible to wildland fire. But right now, there's nothing in the works.
Well, I guess it's always good to be prepared, and that leads me to my last question, because I know you have to go. Cal Fire this afternoon noted that we're living in a, quote, mega fire era, end quote, in which early and large evacuations are going to be more common. It's only August, and this past fire's last year, the fire season extended into late November. How are you guys getting ready, and do you have enough resources?
It's not getting ready. We're there. We continue to fight the fight. Resources, as these fires start getting wrapped up, we'll allocate those resources off those fires to other fires. We have that flexibility and that determination to do so. So again, we have the National Guard on board with, several hand crews with the boots on the ground, aircraft, of course. We have Cal Fire has under contract the 747 and I believe a DC-10 as well. So the air assets are in play. The ground assets are in play. So we have that ability to adapt.
And do you think that this fire will go on for another couple days, another couple weeks?
The LNU is definitely another couple weeks, probably mid-September. Again, it's conducive on the weather. If we get some hot, dry, windy weather, then it's going to put the fire to the test again. And that's something that we continuously work on, getting those contingency lines in and those black lines around the edge of that fire to take that fuel away.
Well, I guess the final word is to be prepared for a long fire season. And we can't thank you enough for all that you and your crews are doing on behalf of Bay Area residents to keep us safe.
And I really appreciate it. And those folks that live in the rural areas, please, I ask that you go to our website, readyforwildfire.org, to learn as to how you can be prepared to be able to evacuate at a moment's notice. And you're right. There's evacuations nowadays are in the hundreds of thousands, and that's unfortunate. And I really expect to see this to go into December as well.
Well, it's something that we'll see in the fall. And thank you so much for joining us, Scott. That was Scott McLean, Chief Information Officer for CAL FIRE. And joining us now is Erin Alday, a health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back to City Visions, Erin.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, usually you and I are talking about the pandemic, and tonight we're actually going to talk about the pandemic plus wildfires. I noticed today in the Chronicle that there was a headline that said, it's like living in Mars, referring to the smoke. Tell us what you know about how we can cope with the smoky skies and air conditions.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues there, you know, especially with this pandemic going on. I think that fortunately, the message is still the same in this pandemic as it is, you know, any other time we've had these kinds of conditions, which is people should stay inside. They should keep their windows and doors closed. Fortunately, things aren't as hot as they were. There was some real concern that we would still be in that kind of triple digit weather in some places, which is a compounding factor when you're asking people to stay sealed up inside and avoid cool places. But we haven't had to really deal with that, fortunately, at least not recently. So it's really just, unfortunately, stay inside. I mean, I'm in the East Bay, and they've closed all of the parks, partly because of the fire danger. But, you know, it's also an air quality thing. It's like they don't really want people out there being active, being outside, breathing in all this gunk anyway. It should be noted that we don't really have any idea how this poor air quality might or might not affect COVID-19 and this pandemic. The truth is that the research about air pollution from wildfire smoke is, it's still kind of, we're still putting that together. We're still not entirely clear about what it does. We know that people who have pre-existing health conditions like asthma, COPD, things like that, that they definitely struggle in these conditions. But for everybody else, and as far as does it make, you know, you more likely to get the coronavirus, does it make people have worse disease, we just don't know the answer to that right now, which is partly why we want people to stay inside and out of it so that we're not messing around with that.
Well, in previous fires, the recommendation was to try to get yourself an N95 mask. Those are hard to come by right now. What is the best recommendation for what kind of mask you should be wearing or could be wearing?
So you're right. You know, we know that N95s are really the only masks that work with wildfire smoke. And the truth is, not only are they hard to come by, but we do not want, you know, people who are not first responders, who are not working in healthcare settings, we don't want anybody trying to get their hands on those masks anyway. So, you know, people who have a stockpile of them, and some people do, especially who, you know, people with conditions who, you know, like asthma, who maybe bought up a bunch of masks in previous years, you know, if they have to go outside, they certainly should wear those. And, you know, I've had some public health officials tell me, you know, reluctantly, that they admit that people should reuse those if they have to, that they should, you know, use them sparingly. But if you have to, you know, keep them clean, keep them, you know, in good shape. And if you need to repeat use, that's fine. Do what you have to do. But really, we just shouldn't be going out in it. Because the other masks, the face coverings that we're all supposed to be wearing at all times, these, you know, anytime we're out in public anyway, these cloth coverings just don't really do much about the wildfire smoke. So we should all be wearing those anyway, but they're kind of a non-issue. They're not going to protect us from that, from whatever, you know, problems might be coming up with the smoke. So it comes down to, you know, if you're somebody who has to work outside, if you're in construction, if you're in something like that, you may, you know, want to talk to your bosses, your employer about, you know, how to protect yourself, but, or try to limit being outside, take whatever precautions you can, but there's not really much you can do because we don't want to be getting into those N95s.
Right. And if you do need to be outside, people are wearing cloth masks and the like, and that's probably affecting businesses that need to, you know, restaurants and the like. So this wildfire is having multiple types of effects. What about people who are in evacuation with the pandemic? How are people in evacuation centers? Are they able to stay there? What's the state or what are the cities doing?
So it's true that the wildfires, these evacuations have put a tremendous strain on our public health resources is what we're looking at. To keep people safe in evacuation centers, we've had to, you know, we need that social distancing. We need everybody wearing the face coverings, and we need to give them space, you know, to stay actually more than 6 feet apart. You know, I talked with the Red Cross, and they've cut their evacuation size in half, meaning that they're keeping it at half capacity of what they would typically. I don't know if you spent any time in evacuation centers, but I have in previous years. And they're not like jam-packed. I mean, people want their own space, but they're definitely, you know, trying to fit as many people as they can into that space and have people be comfortable. But they're cutting that straight in half just because they want to be safe. But that means they need almost twice as many, the evacuation centers. It means they need almost twice as many, the staff, so people to staff those evacuation centers. But they're also trying to send people to other places. They're trying to send people hotel rooms, rent hotel rooms for them. It's complicated because a lot of times you tell people to stay with friends and family, but of course we're all in this pandemic supposed to be staying in our, you know, with our household bubble. So that's kind of a complicating factor too. Some people are doing that anyway, because that just feels like the safest option. I know up in Solano County, they were telling folks that if you have a vehicle that you can live out of for a couple days, that you should do that. Drive somewhere where you can park it safe and stay out of your vehicle if that's an option, if that's a safe option for you. So we're having to come up with a lot of sort of creative solutions to find spaces, safe spaces for people to evacuate, and not have them, you know, also then be exposed to the coronavirus.
Well, I think another problem is that there's so many fires and they're massive, as Scott said, 1.2 million acres. So it's hard to know where to even go. You know, if you're in the North Bay, you can't really go to the South Bay or the East Bay, given the size of these fires.
Problem. Yeah. I mean, it's like ordinarily people would evacuate their county and go to like the next county's hotels or stay with family. I mean, we've had situations where people evacuated to a family or friend's house and then everybody had to evacuate from there. So yeah, exactly. It has this cascading effect. And you're right, we're surrounded and it feels like we're running out of places for people to be.
Well, I don't know if you know this, how firefighters are handling this, but they obviously need to be close together. Maybe they probably have masks on, but is there any concern about the health of the firefighters regarding COVID and these fires?
Yeah, there is. I actually wrote a story about that. I think it maybe ran today, but I'm not sure. But anyway, they are taking a lot of precautions because that's the last thing we need. Obviously, we don't want firefighters getting the coronavirus for their own health. I mean, we just don't want them. That would be terrible to have firefighters get sick while they're fighting these fires. But we also, frankly, as you were just talking previously, we're you know, real tight on resources, on firefighting staff, on the personnel. And what we really can't afford is to have somebody in a unit get sick and then have that whole group of firefighters be in quarantine. And have all of them now not be able to work, which is, you know, a situation that certainly could happen. And they actually have put into place means, protocols to take care of that, to at least deal with that. One of the things is they're not doing the sort of big, massive operational camps where everybody kind of sleeps and eats when they're not on the front lines. So everybody kind of, they're having these isolated camps scattered kind of across a region. They're trying to keep cohorts together. So groups of firefighters and anywhere from like 5 to 20 at a time spend all their time together. They sleep together. They eat together. They're even advising them to do things like if you have to bunk down in a tight space, sleep head to toe. So sleep, you know, with one guy's head at one end and toes at the other, so that at the very least they're not, you know, breathing that same space. So they're taking a lot of those kinds of precautions because it's true. Those folks work in close quarters. They can't really wear masks when they're on the fire lines because it's just not safe for them for a lot of reasons. So we, as you well know, I mean, because of these prison outbreaks that we experienced over the summer, that already, you know, was a factor in our inmate crew force. So, you know, we know that this can be a problem. We know that for a fact. So we definitely want to be on top of that.
I think stories like this is why maybe the Chronicle today ran the story about, like, is this the end of times? I mean, it's just a lot.
It really feels that way. It definitely feels that way. It's so much to deal with. We're all going to need such a long nap at some point in 2021, hopefully.
Well, I can't let you go without talking a little bit about the state of the coronavirus. And, you know, Donald Trump and his administration announced that plasma would be available to assist or to help people with COVID. What's the story there?
I think a lot of people are kind of rolling their eyes a lot at that for a number of reasons. One being that, our understanding is that most people who wanted to get convalescent plasma who felt like they were a good candidate for it were already getting. In fact, one of the problems we've had with studying the effects of convalescent plasma is that it's so widely available that we're having trouble enrolling people in studies, you know, doing that kind of double blind study, because people are like, why am I going to enter a clinical trial when I might not get it if I can just get it already? So it's sort of like, why are we doing that kind of an emergency use authorization when it feels a little unnecessary? But on top of that, I'm sure people will be shocked to know that it sounds like there was some exaggeration of, you know, the effects of the convalescent plasma. It seems pretty clear that there is some some benefit from this, but we really don't know exactly how much. We don't know who is best aided at it. We still need to do all that work, all those studies to really know how effective this is, who should be using it. It's just, there's a lot of big questions mark out there, and it's sort of, you know, questionable as to whether we needed this kind of action.
So from the administration, more questions than answers. I want to thank you again for joining us, Erin Alday, health reporter for San Francisco Chronicle, always here to give us an update on Corona and now Corona and smoke.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me again.
Great talking to you. Coming up next, how can Democrats talk about race in this year's election and win? We'll hear from UC Berkeley's Ian Haney-Lopez about his book, Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. Stay tuned. City Visions. I'm Grace Wan. As the United States reckons with our history of racism and a pandemic that is disproportionately impacting people of color, race promises to feature front and center in this year's election. How can the Democrats talk about racism without alienating white voters? In his most recent book, Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America, UC Berkeley law professor Ian Haney-Lopez offers a game plan and says that by combining the fights for racial and economic justice, Democrats not only win, but may actually create the cross-racial solidarity necessary for meaningful change. Professor Haney-Lopez joins us now to discuss politics, race, and class in America. Welcome, Ian.
Oh, thank you very much. So glad to be able to join you.
And we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send an email to cityvisions@klw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionsKALW. How do you think Democrats can challenge the racism of Donald Trump? Give us a call. So, Ian, it's the first night of the Republican National Convention, and I guess we'll be seeing a lot of Donald Trump over the next four nights. And I don't think there's any doubt that people believe that Donald Trump espouses racist policies, like the Muslim ban or his tweets on everything from immigration to calling certain African countries asshole nations. But you've observed that while Trump might act like a racist, calling him a racist doesn't really do much to advance Democratic election hopes. Why not?
Well, I think we have to back up for a second. There's two things that you've said that are really common in progressive thinking, but that turn out not to be correct or that elide important insights. One is we're not just talking about white folks. So I've run message testing a couple years ago and then again last month, essentially testing a version of Donald Trump's message to see how convincing it is. Majorities of whites find it convincing. They agree with it. So too do majorities of African Americans, majorities of Latinos, majorities of union households, majorities of Democratic voters. So point one, this is a story that's centrally about whites and it's centrally about how whiteness has been weaponized in politics, but it has been weaponized through coded language. And the coded language talks about, for example, people who are dangerous or people who are undeserving, illegals or welfare queens or gangbangers or thugs, or in contrast, hardworking Americans or taxpayers. That sort of language is sufficiently ambiguous that a lot of people of color also find it convincing and also want to locate themselves on the sort of the side of the good people, the side of the taxpayers and the hardworking and the crime victims, not the criminals, the welfare cheats, the illegals. Right? So that's one.
And then the other is to really emphasize that many progressives see clearly that Trump is telling stories that are thinly veiled racism. But we are in the minority. Most people don't see it that way. So now if we turn around and we expect other people to see the world in Trump's language exactly the way we do, we actually alienate a lot of them because, again, majorities of Democrats, majorities of Latinos, African-Americans, they see Trump's message as common sense. Of course we should protect against people who don't respect our laws. Now, if we turn and we say, hey, you know, you think that's common sense, but that's actually bigotry, that says to them, and you might be a bigot, and we think you might be a bigot too, right? And so this is the dynamic. We need to be, and I know that progressives really struggle with this, and but the evidence is really good. Majorities of people do not see Trump's racist poison as racism. They hear it as common sense.
Well, you do. You have a really great analysis of how Trump utilizes or weaponizes racism, and you call it his racist theater or racist theatricals. Can you explain that?
Sure. So I'm so glad you asked that question because it's the perfect follow-up question. What happens when we progressives say Donald Trump's a racist, Donald Trump's a bigot? Well, it turns out that's actually part of the theater of dog whistle politics. That's precisely what he wants us to do. So here's the way the theater goes. Trump will say something that is racially provocative, racially charged, that is something outrageous. Say, hey, people on both sides in Charlottesville, very fine people. Or they should go back to where they came from. Or we need to slam the border on illegals who come from asshole countries that are overrun with drugs and crime. Okay. Now, the minute he says that, then he stops and waits. And he's hoping the progressives will say, that's racism. That's bigotry. Right. So whereupon he will immediately proclaim his innocence. That's step number two, proclaim his innocence. I never said a racist word. I didn't use a racist epithet. I never mentioned color. And then step number three, the counterpunch, he turns around and he says, hey, but you know who did talk, you know who did just talk about racism? The progressives. They called me a racist, and by implication, they called all my supporters racist. And you know who the biggest racists in the world are? People who call others racist just because they're white. And just like that, one, two, three, he's pushed people to think in terms of racist stereotypes, defended himself as innocent, and now recast himself and the people that he pushed into thinking racist stereotypes as the real victims of racism in the United States because they're being accused of being bigots, even though to them it's just common sense.
Well, he seems to have really found a way to be both on the offensive and then make himself the victim and make his supporters victims in that conversation.
That's such a great insight. So if we step back, what Donald Trump is doing is engaging in an American version of demagoguery. And demagoguery really rests on the idea that the majority group, the most powerful group, is in fact the least powerful and the most victimized and the most vulnerable, the group that is being wronged in society. So victimization is precisely at the core of what Trump's doing. Now, the American version focuses primarily on race. And we get this dog whistling from Barry Goldwater and a pivot in the Republican Party in the midst of the civil rights movement in 1963 and 1964. And the basic story Republicans have been telling since then is, hey, white voters, you have been displaced. The Democratic Party and liberals in general care more about, have elevated people of color over you. And this is no longer your America. You are now in peril. And where does that peril come from? It comes from dangerous people of color. It comes from undeserving people of color who are taking more resources, taking things that should otherwise go to you. But the real danger comes from liberal government that favors them over you. And all of this is encapsulated in
Nixon's rhetoric, Trump's rhetoric of American carnage and lawlessness and law and order and the silent majority. There's a very, very strong theme of victimization, even though this is language that is being wielded by the most in order to mobilize the largest racial group, the historically empowered racial group, the racial group that continues to dominate in economics and culture and arts and politics and the military. It is now being wielded by the president of the United States, by, you know, backed by the Senate, backed by this entire right-wing media echo chamber. These are the most powerful people in the country, but they're also the most dangerous when they begin to develop an ideology of victimization in which their violence is reconstituted as self-defense.
Right. And you've mentioned dog whistling. And I know you wrote this great book called Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by the dog whistle?
A dog whistle. So think about the terms that I'm using: illegal alien, welfare queen, homeland security, the American heartland, a hardworking taxpayers. On their surface, none of these terms mention race, and yet they are designed to push people to think in terms of racist stereotypes. And there's an easy way to visualize it. Metaphorically, close your eyes and see who comes to mind. When I say welfare queen, thug, illegal alien, American heartland, the silent majority, hardworking taxpayer, almost all of us conjure images associated with those phrases in color, in racialized terms. So the metaphor is really one of political speech. Like a literal dog whistle sounds at so high a frequency that human ears can't hear it, but dogs can. And that's what's happening with this political speech. On one level, it's silent in the sense that it does not directly or expressly invoke racial terms, let alone racial epithets. And yet underneath, it is designed to trigger sharp reactions to push people into thinking in terms of racist stereotypes.
Well, we're going to talk more about that, but this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking race, class, and this year's election with Ian Haney-Lopez. Are the Democrats talking enough about race? What would you like to hear from Biden and Harris? Join us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org. You can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionsKALW. So we've got the dog whistle out there, Ian, and Biden and Harris, my question to you is, are they doing what enough, or are they saying the right things about race in their presidential run?
Well, let's back up for a second. I mentioned that this dog whistling started in 63 and 64. The Democrats have had plenty of time to figure out how to respond, and they haven't gotten it right. What has happened with the Democrats is they very quickly learned that dog whistling had this three-part theater, and that if they accused Republicans of engaging in race baiting, that actually would backfire and be used against them. From that, they learned the wrong lesson. The lesson Democrats learned from that is, if you can't accuse Republicans of being a bigots, you cannot talk about race at all. That was the wrong lesson. Now, here's what's a little bit worrisome. There are many within the Biden-Harris camp who continue to believe that lesson, who continue to believe that we cannot talk about race because, and that's the part that's wrong, because, and this is the part that's correct, you lose when you call Trump and Republicans bigots. So there's still a sort of a sense among many within the Democratic fold that Democrats should avoid race altogether. Now, there's another group among the Democrats, among progressives, who say, we need to call Donald Trump a bigot because, by God, he is a bigot. And think about all the violence he's doing to communities of color. And now, I understand the impulse there. These are folks who say, if calling him a bigot alienates some folks, we're okay with that. We need to speak truth to power. And
if that were the only alternative, if it were really true that there were only two alternatives, either call them out as bigots or don't talk about race at all, I'd be with the call them out folks. In fact, for a couple decades, I was. But there's a different way to talk about what's happening to us. And that is to recognize that race is being used, it is being promoted by powerful elites in order to divide all of us. And simply naming that reality actually creates a different way to build a multiracial coalition. It names race, it names racial division. We absolutely must do that. But it doesn't frame racism as fundamentally a problem of white people, of bigotry and of bigoted Republican voters or people who are susceptible to racism. Rather, it frames racism first and foremost as a weapon of powerful elites against all the rest of us. And this is a message that I developed, that I tested, brought together teams of experts. We've poll tested it. We've run it through focus groups. It's an incredibly powerful message. It really resonates with people. And it's a simple message. And I'm hoping it resonates with the audience now. So here's the message. We all want to take care of our families. It doesn't matter what color we are, where we come from. But right now, some political elites, some leaders are intentionally dividing us because when we fight each other, they can more easily run the government for themselves and their billionaire backers. Let's come together across these differences, especially across race lines, to build a multiracial progressive majority that elects new leaders who ensure that government actually works for all of us and not for corporations. That's the message. That's what Harris and Biden ought to be running with.
Well, I think you said it really pithily in your book when you write, because the truth is, racism's bottom line has always been more about money than about hate. And so you're pairing racism with class. And I think in your book, you note that when Trump and his administration focus on race with the dog whistles, they're kind of distracting us from some really big things that they're doing, you know, like packing the courts with conservative judges or tax cuts for billionaires or rolling back environmental regulations. Can you talk a little bit about how this is all the theater of distraction so that we're focused on one thing when the other hand is doing lots of other things that we're not even talking about?
No one better personifies dog whistle politics as class war through racial division than Donald Trump. Now, he may or may not be a billionaire, but he's certainly part of the billionaire class. And his allegiance.
He'd like to be. He definitely would like to be there.
That's his allegiance, his social right. allegiance, cultural allegiance.
Yeah.
What has he accomplished? A multi-trillion-dollar tax cut for the wealthiest Americans and the biggest corporations. But what has he done publicly? Stressed and promoted racial division. And even when we think about the courts, Trump is packing the courts with the support of evangelicals by telling them what you're getting are justices who will participate in a culture war to defend you, to defend your vision of patriarchy and family relations. But what they're actually getting is the most business-friendly Supreme Court in over a century. Right? And the same thing with environmental regulations. Trump is saying, oh, this is Obama and this is Paris and they want to make you flush your toilet multiple times, right? He's trying to turn environmentalism into a culture war issue. But his biggest backer are the Koch brothers or Koch Industries. Industry is profiting handsomely from a culture war politics that gets us fighting each other while the rich laugh all the way to the bank. That's Donald Trump to a gilded T.
I hear what you're saying, but I was surprised to read today in the paper that according to a recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, Donald Trump has almost a 50% approval rating on his handling of the economy. The people on both sides of the aisle think his supporters think he's doing great. And there are a lot of undecideds who think that the economy is fine. What do you say to somebody like that?
Such a great question. Such an important insight packed there. So many of us believe that voters are relatively informed and are making decisions based upon good information about what's happening in society and are reflecting on their policy preferences and then are reacting to the policy promises being made by the politicians. It's just flat wrong. There's a terrific book called Democracy for Realists that spends, I don't know, I think it's more of a tome, 600 pages or so.
Well, then you should synopsize it for us right now.
The point is, people vote in terms of identity. Everybody votes in terms of identity. And when I say identity, I mean a set of three questions. Who am I in this society? Am I valued? Am I respected? What's my position? That's number one. Number two, who threatens me? Number three, who are my allies? These are identity questions. And what Trump is doing every day is he's using racist lies to answer those questions. He is saying, if you're white or at least lighter, you are esteemed, you built this country, you can be proud of this country, but you're also under immediate threat. Who is it that threatens you? Violent and undeserving people. Implicitly dark-skinned people, whether they're immigrants or Muslims or African-American. And who are your allies? Your allies are business leaders, because you cannot trust your neighbor. Government actually does more to protect those violent, undeserving people than to favor you. You're fundamentally on your own. In a cultural sense, you're on your own correlates to go buy a gun. That's where the NRA fits into this. In an economic sense, it correlates to you're on your own in the marketplace. Trust business leaders to run this like a market. This is the only way to take care of yourself. That's the story he's telling. And because that story is the same story Republicans have been telling for 50 years, it's quite compelling to people. Now, once they say, okay, who am I? I'm esteemed by, I'm under threat. Who threatens me? Those other people in the Democrats. Who's got my back? Donald Trump. Everything else follows. Trump says the economy's good. I believe the economy's good. Trump says don't wear a mask. I'm not going to wear a mask. Trump says he's been great on coronavirus and the pandemic. I believe him. That's what's happening. And it's so important for us to realize, because so often progressives say, you know, talk about social justice, racial justice, patriarchy, all of us talking about social justice and say, that's identity politics. Let's focus on policy. It's like, policy is a great way to be out of power for decades. Let's talk about identity, but let's make sure that as progressives, we are articulating a vision of identity in which almost all of us can see ourselves and see a place in the society in which we're esteemed, in which our allies, our other people, our neighbors, our friends, our community, people we haven't met yet, people who look different than us, have different sexual orientations, different religions, different languages, but they're our allies. They're in it together. And who threatens us? Powerful elites intentionally stoking division and pushing us to fight each other. That's the story that progressives can tell. To build the multiracial democracy, we have a multiracial society. Can we build a multiracial democracy in which all of our families can thrive? We need an identity story to do that.
Well, it seems that at the Democratic National Convention, there was a lot of emphasis on empathy and seeing each other for who we are. And at the same time, maybe the progressive wing of the party didn't get as much play. I noticed over the weekend that Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez noted that as well. She said, if I was in charge, I probably would have brought a more progressive tone to it, but I wasn't in charge and that's okay. Is there something more that the Biden-Harris ticket should be saying more explicitly?
Yes, very definitely. I think that there's, let me step back for a second. The way that many progressives understand social justice issues, especially for subordinated groups that they're not part of, is that it's a matter of justice, of morality, of empathy. And I agree with all of that. I'm not criticizing any of that. Sure, justice requires racial equality. Empathy requires helping people who are poor. I get that. But at the same time, they're fundamentally mistaking what is happening in our society. In our society, social fault lines have been promoted, have been funded, have been exploited by the most powerful elements of our society to get us to turn against each other. And what that means is that bridging differences, overcoming social fault lines, is not first and foremost a matter of justice or empathy. It is a pragmatic necessity for survival. And when I say survival, that sounds a little dramatic, but the first segment in today's show was basically climate change is coming to get us, and it's coming hard, right? And it can be fires, it can be tornadoes, it can be heat, it can be crises over water. What is required to avert climate collapse? Defeating the political power of the Koch industries. What is required to do in that? Recognizing that their primary strategy is to fund Donald Trump, Tea Party, racial division. Do you want to avert climate collapse? We have to build cross-racial solidarity as a matter of survival. And by the way, let me just say, Sunrise Movement has a new book. It's coming out right now, Green New Deal. And part of it is that they're recognizing the Green New Deal is addressing economic injustice and racial injustice, not simply because they're progressives and they want to throw everything in there, but because all of those are completely and inseparably linked. And that's the thing that I think that progressives or that Biden and Harris need to be saying. We're coming together because we value taking care of each other, because it's the right thing to do, because we want to adopt and promote an ethic of empathy. Yes. And we're doing it because we want our own families to have a society, a democracy, and a planet that is survivable for our children and our grandchildren. This is survival solidarity. And it's also moral, and it's also based on empathy. But it is pragmatically the most immediate and most important thing all of us can be doing.
I also wondered if, you know, using your framework of racist theater, if the right has also weaponized the word socialism and made things like the Green New Deal that you mentioned or Medicare for All seem like a way to take away individual rights and to create, you know, death panels and the like. Is that what's happening here?
You know, a word like socialism is really doing double duty. On one level, it has a political content to it, especially for people. Let's say you were talking to Venezuelan immigrants and they've got real experience with socialism. Okay, then the word socialism has some reference point. For most Americans, even in the 1960s, communism and anti-communism and socialism really became a way of talking about something that was a fundamental threat to the American way of life. And the American way of life is connected to a logic of capitalism, but far more fundamentally, it's connected to a logic of racial dominance. So if you think, I think about the 50s, the 60s, that's the heyday of the New Deal, the Great Society, and you have all these industrialists running around and saying this is socialism. And the American public overwhelmingly in landslide elections is saying, we don't care. We want government to take an active role in regulating the marketplace and taxing the economic winners and building routes of upward mobility. Social Security, here we come. Medicare, let's do it. When does it begin to gain traction? When communism is a word that is attached to Martin Luther King, he's a communist. And similarly with socialism, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, socialist, right? The word, I think in contemporary political valence, it's a way of saying that's a bad person. But what is it that makes them bad? First and foremost, in Trump's rhetorical world, it's the challenge to white dominance that makes these people scary, threatening, dangerous. That's the lie that he's constantly promoting. Now he's also providing a rhetoric that people can use to express that profound sense of discomfort without having to come across as racist. Right? They don't need to use a racial epithet. You can think about all of these sort of attacks on Barack Obama. I mean, some of them were so over the top. Most of them, Tea Party, I'm thinking, most of them avoided racial epithets, but instead said, Obama's Hitler. Right? It's like, in no way, shape, or form, except in the sense that Hitler embodies evil, so now it's applied to Obama. But how was Obama evil? He was pictured that way because of the way he challenged the racial order.
Right. And in the last couple of months, obviously, we've seen our nation convulsed in protest and mourning with the Black Lives Matter movement and the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. I mean, even last night in Wisconsin, the police shooting of Jacob Blake. How has that, the galvanizing of the Black Lives movement in the last few months changed or not changed how you view the race class, conversation?
It's an incredible moment. What is happening is, to put this in the sort of a 400-year context, racism and capitalism arise together as a way for empowered elites to explain the brutality of turning people into property, the brutality of driving people off their land, the brutality of purposeful genocide. Ever since then, the racism has worked in a way that closes people's hearts and minds to others. It leads them to dehumanize others, to see them as not suffering pain the same way, not having the same value, not having the same dreams. And we as a society have been fighting against that fitfully, some progress, some regression, some progress. We're now deep in a valley. In this valley, I think if the pinnacle, if the latest high point was really the civil rights movement, we started a long slide since then. And I think people mistook the election of Barack Obama as some new pinnacle. But I think the election of Barack Obama sort of signals some improvement, but also an avoidance with just how deeply racism remains a part of our society. Donald Trump, his campaign in 2015, his election in 2016, his governing style has really brought racism to the fore. And a lot of people are looking at it now in ways that they hadn't seen it before. And I think that the heartbreaking, the horrifying videos of police killings over and over and over again, video after video, just the chilling indifference of the police when they kill people is really forcing a confrontation with the reality of racism as dehumanization, the likes of which we really haven't seen. And in that sense, this is another huge step forward. At the same time, it remains incredibly important to add the brutality that we are witnessing by the police is not first and foremost a product of white racism in general. It's not first and foremost a product of particular bigoted police officers. It is directly and proximately caused by politicians who for the last 50 years have been campaigning through stories of people of color as dangerous criminals, and then have turned around and governed by funding the massive buildup of police forces, by funding the militarization of police forces, by funding the building of prisons all over our country. In other words, to truly understand where police brutality and mass incarceration come from, we need to look at racism as a class weapon, because it is elites seeking to win power by telling racial fear stories who have turned around, caused us to fear each other, and built the prisons and militarized the police. And likewise, to really end police violence against communities of color, we have to see that this is the same battle as the battle for economic justice for everybody. It's the same political fight We need to join together across racial lines with everybody to elect leaders who will simultaneously get government back from corporations to help people on an economic front, and at the same time, stop using government as a source of violence against communities of color, and actually begin to use government as a source of repair for the last five decades of systematic violence, but on top of that, for the last several hundred years of racial hierarchy.
Well, I think I want to mention, and it would be remiss of me not to, that your approach of class and race, coupling that together in the conversation, is really backed by some deep and longstanding research that you did in the field with some very well-respected pollsters and analysts. And you've also created a Race Class Academy. And in our last minute or two that we have, can you tell us, our listeners, about the project, which you can find at race-class-academy.com?
Yeah, here's the idea. This message, hey, we're being intentionally divided, we should come together, it has immediate intuitive appeal, and that's what makes it such a strong political message. And just to reiterate, I've worked with pollsters, both a big study in 2018 and another study I just completed last month, really shows this is the best performing message to bring people together. But it's also a paradigm shift in how we think about race. To move from thinking about race as fundamentally a conflict between whites and people of color to realizing it's fundamentally about profit. Yeah, the white, non-white hierarchy is there, but it's fundamentally about profit. That's an idea that it takes a little bit of time to work through. And so I've created a set of videos to break these ideas down into easily digestible chunks, along with discussion guides. And I hope that it's a resource that people can use to work through it themselves, but also as a basis to share with their neighbor, share with their family, and talk through it with folks to really get our heads around this core insight. We are all in this together. We're being intentionally divided, but we are all in this together.
Well, we're all in this together, and you've given people a lot to think about, as well as a good advice for how to get through tough conversations with aunts and uncles over the Thanksgiving table, I think, when you have to talk about race and class and these tough election issues. I'd like to thank my guest, Ian Haney-Lopez. He's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America, and also the author of Dog Whistle Politics. Thanks so much for joining us, Ian.
Thank you.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Thanks to all of my guests this evening. And for a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Susie Britton. And it featured the music from the San Francisco band, The Union Trade. Join us next week for a conversation about the work of local groups who are pairing up with voters in swing states to advance their prerogatives in the November elections. Good night, and thanks for listening. Stay safe.